This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Atlas of a Lost World, Travels in Ice Age America by Craig Childs. This book is read by Craig Childs. For Sharon, the mom who whispered in my ear, go. It's how they say we arrived here, from a cave, in the beginning. Linda Hogan. Prologue. Nothing stirred in the bowels of the earth. Bones lay on bones in silence. A cave sealed shut, its entrance collapsed in the middle of the Pleistocene, the last geologic epoch before our own. Anything stuck inside never got out. The first inkling of new life was the white light of a headlamp and the scratch of small metal tools. I lay on my side with my hard hat off, working on a camel that had died back here, an awkward place for anything to die, I thought. It was in a crack in the backside of a small chamber, which is why they gave the site to me. I was in my early 30s, base camp cook for a museum crew, working on one of the most prolific Pleistocene bone-producing sites in the American West, Porcupine Cave, in the mountains of south-central Colorado, churning out rodent bones for the most part with the occasional hurrah of discovering skeletal cheetah kittens, the toe bones of horses, cores of bison horns. Elsewhere, a dozen excavators and screeners were pulling up a treasure trove of Pleistocene porcupines and squirrels, filling and labeling bags, while I was alone in a hole with Camelops hesternus. I imagined the camel crawling into the cave, its hindquarters slashed by saber-tooths or hamstrung by direwolves, trying to save itself, dying here. When silver miners first blasted into the mountainside in the 1860s, they accidentally clipped one of the cave's chambers. So they propped up the tunnel with wooden posts and beams. Then they dropped into it with their oil wick lamps and found passageways, crystals, and domed rooms. Floors buried in dust, bones sealed in place 300,000 years ago. Now a ladder brought paleontologists down through the hole the miners had opened. They moved through the rotten molasses smell of wood rat urine into the dark, crawling through low spots, pushing gear ahead, headlamps shining on each other's boot soles. They went to their own trenches and pits, screens and vacuums, setting up grids, fingers picking through countless rodent bones. I went to the camel. Animal bones had been dragged in by wood rats, though some skeletons, like that of the camel, were complete. The biggest mammals of the age were being found elsewhere, rock shelters and muddy pond bottoms holding the remains of mammoths, mastodons, giant bison, direwolves, large fanged cats, sloths with foot-long claws, and a 6-foot-tall beaver with incisors like medieval weapons. These creatures, including the camel, are known as Rancho Librean megafauna, named after copious Ice Age finds at the La Brea Tar Pits in Southern California, some of the largest mammals of the Pleistocene. Gigantism among mammals is associated with cold. This is known as Bergman's rule, after the 19th century German biologist Carl Bergman, who noticed that the larger examples of most species tend to occupy colder climates, while the smaller tend to be found in warmer places. Warmth produces smaller bodies that expel heat, while cold encourages extra layers of big bones, muscle, fat, and fur, resulting in bodies with a smaller ratio of surface area to volume and a greater ability to hold in heat. Glacial periods, long, cold spells that often lasted 100,000 years at a time, were frequent in the Pleistocene, when the Earth on average dropped to 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit, below temperatures we experience today. This gave rise to animals with large bodies and Ice Age megafauna weighing a ton or more. The largest American mammoths came in at around 10 tons, 3 tons more than the largest African elephants. I was drawing slow circles around the eye of an animal that had once weighed about 1,700 pounds, just shy of a ton. I picked out pieces of yellowish earth from where one of its eyeballs had once rotated in its socket, seeing big cats coming, watching sunsets on glaciers and wind blowing across the lush intermountain grasslands. None of the animals found in this cave had encountered a human being. The scientists joked about finding an artifact, a stone projectile, but it wouldn't happen. This camel never knew spears or hunting dogs or the smell of campfires. The land from Alaska to the tip of South America, 9,000 latitudinal miles of mountains, rivers, plains, and coastlines, had no humans, No deliberately sharpened rocks or bones flaked and polished to a point. This was the last large habitable part of the world that the human race discovered. Nobody arriving until the tail end of what is known as the Wisconsin Ice Age, a glacial period that lasted about 100,000 years and ended 10,000 years ago at the close of the Pleistocene. Neighboring Eurasia had been foraged by tool-wielding hominids for a million years or more. Early human species from Spain to Indonesia were cutting meat and skins with stone knives, building fires, sometimes burying their dead in caves and rock shelters, and duking it out with other hominids. All the while, nobody made it this far around the globe. The first humans, anatomically modern Homo sapiens, left Africa between 100,000 and 70,000 years ago. These people were nearly identical to us. Give them a haircut and modern clothes, and they'd be hard to pick out in a crowd. Their size, hairiness, and skin color easily within our own contemporary range. They left their home continent along the bottom of Saudi Arabia, jumping the Red Sea at the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb at Djibouti, the same place baboon populations had already swum across to populate the Middle East. It is as if humans saw the baboons and dived in after them, figuring they had to be going somewhere. From there, the path of humans is marked by stone blanks called preforms. They appear to have been an invention of Homo sapiens, a stone worked down to carrying size, something that could be fashioned into whatever might be needed, blades, projectiles, scrapers, or the small hand chisels called burins, pointed rocks gripped between fingers and thumb and used to sharpen and refinish weapons and tools. Instead of grabbing whatever rock could be found and working it into a sharp wedge, as early hominids were wont to do, this new people had the best resources in hand and ready to go. Their traveling toolkits allowed them farther and faster movement and access to better weapons and tools as needed. A weapon called a biface spread along with these preforms. Bifaces were stone points and blades napped from both sides for lightness and efficiency. Our species was armed, mobile, and pushing rapidly into the world, going beyond the reach of anything before them, and the world kept opening to them. By 48,000 years ago, humans reached the unpopulated Pleistocene supercontinent of Sahul, which consisted of Australia, Tasmania, and New Guinea fused together at lower sea levels. It is assumed that people used boats to get there. The minimum number of people needed for even a remote chance of long-term survival is 40, meaning at least that many had to cross open water to reach Sahul. They were not a desperate handful clinging to a log, adrift, without a plan, but a group making a concerted effort, a small and daring population deliberately taking to the water, convinced something worthwhile was out there. Around the same time, other populations of Homo sapiens were pushing beyond their northern boundaries into lobes of ice and the mammoth-studded steppe of Upper Siberia. A mammoth butchered by stone or bone tools 45,000 years ago was found in the Siberian north near the Arctic Sea. A 40,000-year-old human leg bone emerged from the banks of the Irtysh River in western Siberia, its DNA half-human and half-Neanderthal. There was never an easy way to get to this side of the planet. Hemmed in by the world's two largest oceans, the Pacific and Atlantic, and often capped in ice, the Americas seemed to be off-limits. The only land connection was exposed during glacial periods when the Arctic land bridge appeared between Siberia and Alaska. By 24,000 years ago, there were game-hunting settlements within a season's walk of the Bering land bridge, though some believe people made it across by 40,000 years ago, or even earlier. Scientists squabble over the locations and dates of human arrival in the New World. They shy away from words like earliest or first, knowing there will always be new and earlier discoveries. What is evidence? What is not? Is that a bone point or just a pointed bone? Were those mammoth and mastodon remains deliberately broken by tools and butchered, or is the damage a natural result of erosion and trampling and time? Age makes the Paleolithic record hard to read. There is no agreed-upon entry point or date. Artifacts were not left carpeting the ground like souvenirs of a Moorish invasion. This was the farthest end of the world, the back door on human expansion. Numbers would have been few, and encampments would have been far between as the people found their way across the land bridge, kicking off one of the greatest experiments in global history. This is a love story. Boy meets girl, if you will. One partner is an unpeopled hemisphere, the other is our hungry, inquisitive species. Some might tell you that the encounter wasn't love at all, but domination, overkill, an invasive species hell-bent on spreading into a land that was doing just fine as it was, without us. Some scientists have called it blitzkrieg, mammoths felled like cordwood. Ours was no docile species, and the animals were not ready for us, or our weaponry. Archaeologists from Alaska to Florida have found Paleolithic spear points and stone blades still holding protein signatures from the meat of horse, camel, sloth, bison, bear, and the proboscideans, mammoths, and mastodons. Ice Age bones in the Americas have been found scribed with human butchering marks, blackened from fires, but humans didn't always win. Many died. Some were eaten. First people, wildly outnumbered by animals, would have found themselves tossed and trampled by tusks and hooves or torn to pieces by the scissoring teeth of scimitar cats. No matter how well-armed they were, even with Eurasian wolf dogs at their sides, surviving among Rancho La Brea megafauna would have been challenging. Nobody said love would be easy. I apologized out loud when I accidentally peeled a sliver of damp bone from the camel's skull. It seemed only polite to say something. The animal said nothing in return, silent as always. Our engagement back here felt like the first encounter between human and American megafauna. By sleight of scientific hand, I had slipped in before the first people, and this camel would have been bewildered to see me. It would never have encountered an animal so pale or so oddly limbed, gathered at its wildly bulging eye like a fleshy crab. At lunch, everyone else left the cave and shut down the generator up top so they could eat in peace. I stayed below because my days here had to be quick. I had to leave the cave early, run 2 miles back to camp to start dinner, and get a campfire going. With the generator off, all the work chambers fell into darkness as I kept working, the only light in the pit of the earth. I heard the thunk of a mammoth tusk striking rock on the surface above, where it swept through snow with its tusks looking for winter browse. A Colombian mammoth, the largest of its kind in the world, was 13 feet tall at the shoulder. I kept digging and scratching as I felt the distant boom of its steps as it moved its tonnage forward. Big cats would have been quieter, and I strained to listen for them padding across the ground above me. I did not imagine the sound of people, no crack of stone on stone or swish of a wooden rod making fire. Instead, I imagined the country empty of us, long before human eyes. In my imagination, I rose up through the original entrance of Porcupine Cave, shielding my eyes from sunlight across glaciers, shaggy beasts of tusks and hooves grazing in the valley below. Continents would have been in the same positions, mountains and plains mostly unmoved, rivers in more or less the same places as they are now. More ice existed than we have today, storing water on land in the form of glaciers and ice caps, causing sea levels to drain by a few hundred feet, rewriting the coastlines. 10 years ago is not hard to imagine. 100 is well within grasp. You've probably known people who've lived that long. 1,000 years is 10 lifetimes. 10,000 years is 100 lifetimes. It was around 250 lifetimes ago that people began to arrive in North America, into the teeth of Ice Age megafauna. I listened through the cave for the moment before this arrival, a time without time. Under the pressing weight of limestone, no sign of light but my own, it became hard to tell which time was which. The skeleton was articulated. The animal had not moved from where it fell. Bones were in place like a time machine. The camel's head slumped into a low passageway. I was here like a seed blown into a cave, random, unexpected. How long would I last? How, without an atlas, would I find my place? I listened for the Pleistocene, but all I heard was the scratch-scratch of my fine metal pick, followed by the hush of the artist's brush I was using. In an ancient hole, only my headlamp shining through the blackness, I inhabited two worlds at once. One was an occupied continent, streaming with freeways and lights. The other was this camel's land, a kingdom of animals, plants, and fungi. Eurasia would soon tip into the Americas. A land bridge with a navigable coast would be found. I whispered to this camel, "Your world is about to change." Atlas of a Lost World. Chapter 1. Land Bridge. Date unknown. Before maps, we had elevation. We used mind instead of paper, and the contours of the land were recorded in our bodies. A knoll, a mountaintop, any high point would do. The earth unfolded before us. From the flats of the Bering Land Bridge, the eye sees about a mile. Several hundred feet of elevation up a mountain or high hill can add 30 miles of visibility. You could have walked for weeks across the land bridge through a mosaic of rivers and grasslands with hardly a rise in the ground before you reached a small mountain range, isolated in the middle of it all. It was a cluster of gray volcanoes standing like a beacon. No one would have known what lay ahead. The view from the flanks of these volcanoes would have revealed more of the same. No coast in sight, horizons continuing on as if constantly giving birth to themselves. Mammoths, Pleistocene horses, and giant bears strung out as far as the eye could see. It must have seemed as if there were no end, the generosity of this planet unimaginable. Around midnight, I came up the slope of the Kukulagat Mountains. A storm was washing in from the north, clouds running low and wet across St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea, once the highest point on the land bridge. 3 degrees below the Arctic Circle in July, the hour was a luminous dusk. Plum-colored storm touching ground, fingers of fog and cloud obscuring the distances. A little birthmark on the globe, a fulcrum between continents. This island belongs to Alaska and the United States, and is occupied by Siberian Yupik people, as if the two sides of the world could not help fusing here. St. Lawrence Island is a remnant of the land bridge that once held Asia to North America, now a misshapen bean 90 miles from end to end. The name Bering Land Bridge is a misnomer. Never mind Vitus Bering, the jowly Danish cartographer and explorer who led sailing expeditions for the Russian Navy along the Upper Pacific Rim in the 18th century, and after whom the Bering Sea and the Bering Strait were named. When this was land and not water, the land bridge was not a catwalk teetering from one hemisphere to the next, but a flat subcontinent fully exposed when sea levels were at their glacial low, its center 500 miles from the nearest coast. I would have looked across a steppe grassland and the occasional birch and black spruce grove, summers free of snow, ground grazed and turned to grass by large herbivores, loess blown in from the edges of distant ice caps, allowing the soil to hold and retain organic matter. This would have been an easily habitable landscape. Winters were dark and furiously cold, but summers produced copious wildflowers, their pollen found in cores taken from the bottom of the Bering Sea. The land bridge had experienced a unique regime of global weather patterns, the Pacific curling up warmly against its southern coast, Himalayan ice cap blocking precipitation from a quarter of the world away, and the mass of the land bridge itself holding its own temperature, a terrestrial heat sink. Inland precipitation was sparse, winter snows frigid but light. Land bridge summers were sunnier than those experienced on St. Lawrence Island. Temperatures slightly warmer, more muskeg and grass than permafrost, snowpack melting earlier for longer growing seasons. This was the American Atlantis, and it went under wave by wave, storm by storm. The sea has closed in, the ice caps melted, sea levels at a high stand and rising. This high point wouldn't have smelled of water-fat clouds drawing off a cold, dark sea. Every night I took these walks, feeling the land bridge roll under my feet. I'd take advantage of the strange, intoxicating light and let go of our current geologic age, the Holocene, giving up my own time for another. The mammoth steppe of the Pleistocene would have extended away from me in great parks of grass and tundra, mammoths grazing, lions watching from the hill slope. One day, never quite giving way to the next, as the sun touched just below the horizon before rising again. Some nights I went out into the sleet and I put my back against the wind, raincoat soaking through. Other nights the sky lay across the island like a blanket, clouds insulating, and I moved in stillness. Tonight, windows of visibility opened between squalls, corridors of tundra revealed and removed like a hall of mirrors. My mom had come with me on this trip, joining me on the plane out of Nome. Each night I waited till she fell asleep on her cot back in Savunga, then slipped out the door. I was still carrying part of a sandwich she'd made but hadn't eaten, a snack for an evening stroll. The first people to come here were not colonizers, in the sense of a planned invasion, kings and queens lifting their chalices to fleets of ships bound for the horizon. If Ice Age people were sent by anything, it was the push and pull of the climate, the drive of human curiosity, and the tidal movement of other animals within which the people flowed. I doubt they would have considered themselves colonists, or that they had any idea of the scale of emptiness that lay ahead. The sense of animals around these people would have been constant. Woolly mammoths the size of garbage trucks, their tusks 13 feet long and curved upward. Giant mammals were hungry, their homeothermic bodies requiring constant feeding in a vast grassland ecosystem at its evolutionary peak during the Ice Age. A healthy mammoth would have taken in more than 600 pounds of browse a day and put out 400 pounds of dung. Scientists working on a 400-square-mile preserve of Pleistocene ecosystems in Siberia have analyzed the fossils found there to calculate original animal biomass, arriving at 10 tons of animal per square kilometer. That's one mammoth, 5 bison, 6 horses, and 10 caribou, plus an accompaniment of big cats and wolves. It wasn't necessarily emptiness ahead. The land was not abandoned. It was alive and had been so for a long time. I'd been told not to walk more than 3 miles past the village. Any farther, and the land turns wilder. Not Ice Age wilder, just Holocene, small stuff. Polar bears have been sighted in the area, though the locals seemed more worried about wolves. I was told they descend from the mountains on stormy nights like this, using the fog as cover. The wolves sounded prehistoric in the descriptions I heard. One was said to have chased down a four-wheeler and ripped the fender off with its teeth as if biting into the haunch of a fleeing reindeer. These sounded like monster stories to me, what they tell kids and visitors like me to keep us from wandering out too far and getting into trouble. That particular day, the village council gave me permission to go more than 3 miles. Tonight, I bumped it up to 4. Drawn into the swirl of clouds and green earth, forgetting the sea behind me and the village, I kept going. Island residents are mostly Siberian Yupik, a subsistence culture that has lived here for at least 2,000 years. St. Lawrence Island has 2 villages, Savunga being the nearest, population 650 or so. I found that people shot, trapped, or threw nets at almost everything that moved. A Yupik hunter told me that the wolves were particularly difficult, retreating into the island's interior to avoid being trapped or shot. Polar bears? They knew what to do with polar bears. A polar bear came too close to the village a few weeks earlier and was now a robe hanging behind one of the houses, grease turned to amber, eyes like buttonholes. Wolves were harder to kill. Grizzlies and polar bears lived this far north in the Ice Age, but the big inland bear was the now extinct Arctotis simus, the short-faced bear. Its forelimbs were elongated, with a grip large enough to wrap around a muskox or horse or a juvenile mammoth. The New World was its home turf, a new animal for people moving west to east. I felt that I'd been here before, had walked into these grassy slopes on a sunny day, horses in the distance lifting their heads, watching me pass. Wildflowers would have been blowing in a warm breeze. I would not have sauntered along like a Nimrod, though, hands in my pockets. I would have been more alert. Early Siberians inserted stone blades into the shafts of their spears, increasing the depth and ease of penetration into walls of flesh. No chewed-on human bones have been found up here, though I can't imagine much would have been left after an attack from a 400-pound scimitar cat or a pack of Beringian wolves. Something moved far ahead. I stopped and squinted, tried to pick it out, but my eye wasn't accustomed to these green waves of tundra. Near and far looked the same. The storm obscured any sense of distance or scale. It was animal, that much I could tell. It had a canid appearance, dog-like, tracking back and forth. All the dogs were chained up back in the village, waiting for winter. They wouldn't be out here. Was it a fox? It was hard to tell from this far away. I glanced back at the village. The roofs of Savunga huddled at least 4 miles behind me, like urchins at the edge of the sea. One-story houses gathered around a school with a gymnasium and no road access to the rest of the world. Whale hunters, seal eaters. I walked on, losing the movement I glimpsed, picking it up again. The animal split into 2. My eye struggled to smooth the distance. Wolves, I thought. I was seeing 2 wolves. I had thought the people in Savunga were kidding about wolves. Canis lupus was extirpated from this island around the 1920s. When I asked an old man in front of a wood stove about this new appearance, he shrugged and said they must have come over from Siberia, crossing on sea ice the last time it froze solid enough, a decade or 2 ago. I looked at the animals' tails. Foxes move with their tails down, dusting the tundra. Wolves with their tails raised. These tails were raised. I suddenly understood what the people in the village had been talking about. I was unarmed and had no idea how long these two animals had been heading in my direction. In Savunga that day, I'd been given a small, colorful slip of glossy paper that read, Land Crossing Permit. A representative from the council ran into me in the street, pulled it out of her jacket pocket, and told me the council had decided I was worth the risk. I'd been hanging around the village long enough that they must have decided that I was okay, or that at least if I were attacked by animals, it wouldn't be from a lack of warning. I was researching a climate change project, using the island as a base for writing and interviews, taking in local anecdotes, describing new species in the waters, stormier summers and winters distressingly warmer. I was told of coastal landmarks and beaches going under year by year. I slipped the permit into the space in my wallet where a driver's license is supposed to be. I now had permission to walk across the Bering Land Bridge, given by the oldest people on the land. Honored, I took it with a small, nervous gulp that I hoped the woman hadn't noticed. If I were ever asked if I belonged here, anywhere in the Americas, I could open my wallet and say, why, yes, I do. I kept walking, figuring I was better off if the wolves didn't notice me noticing them. If they were indeed wolves and not a pair of half-feral sled dogs escaped and running back to the village, animals I'd rather not encounter either. Wolves might be curious, never allowed to get this close to a human. They could see I had no rifle over my shoulder. They understood me by the way I walked. What did I have to defend myself? Fingernails and teeth? A loud voice? My mom's half-eaten sandwich? Dread sank through my stomach and settled into the notch of my groin. Out here, I was naked, no bush or boulder to duck behind. In the Ice Age, I'd be adrift in blueberries and wildflowers. Looking up and seeing a pair of Beringian wolves loping toward me, I may have had a similar sinking feeling. Beringian wolves were boxier than modern wolves, larger skulls, necks a few inches longer, heavier muscle connections, more robust teeth to handle the larger prey of the late Pleistocene. I would have been prepared, at least had a knife or a blade, a sharpened bifacial stone wrapped in leather, a dog, a buddy, a tribe. I would not have been alone like this, 4 miles from anyone. This would not have happened. They looked leaner than the wolves I'd been told about. Blonde, patchy brown, tails lifted. They lived in the rugged middle of the island. I let myself down into a gentle draw, and as soon as I was out of their sight, I spun and started swiftly back for the village. Foxes, dogs, or wolves, it didn't matter. I made tracks out of there. The kind people of Savunga had offered my mom and me a place to stay, a pressboard second-story meeting room where my sleeping bag was already laid out on a cot. She was probably sighing in her sleep. I thought ahead to the schoolroom clock on the wall, the microwave sitting obediently next to a stack of cups, and my socks laid out to dry on a piece of roller luggage. I wanted to be there instead of here. I wanted what everyone wants, to be protected from the trials and fears of the unknown. Most of the world's large predators have been exterminated or driven to the far corners. We have all but forgotten how to inhabit this kind of fear. We give up spears and skins and the weather on us day and night for cup holders and cell phones and doors to close behind us. What, I wonder, was lost? A mammoth kill on the Russian plane left part of a spear point in a rib. Judging by its embedded depth, considering the skin and muscle the projectile had to penetrate to reach bone, the spear must have been thrown from about 15 feet away, proof that people got very close to excessively large animals. My mouth felt dry, and I thought, my God, I've grown soft. I could scarcely imagine myself approaching any animal with no more than a sharpened stick or a stone point. That kind of involvement with wildlife has escaped most of us. Now, at the slightest sign of canids, I was hightailing it for home. When my cover played out, I stopped and looked back at the fog-obscured terrain. Distances turned in and out of each other, and I saw the wolves again, closer. I fell into an easy pace, not wanting to be seen in a spotting scope from the village, a fool running with his hat clamped down on his head, fleeing from a pair of curious wolves. I knew wolves mostly from the lower 48, night howlers in Wyoming and Montana. I still listened for them in the backcountry of Arizona. But those wolves were hemmed in by a human tapestry of roads and towns. What did I know of hungry Siberian wolves stranded on an Arctic island? I continued through draws and hills until the village was a couple miles away. My view had planed out, elevation flattening, houses on top of each other behind the gravel slash of a landing strip, shipping containers stacked along one side, towering white wind turbines. The wolves, if I were brave, or the foxes, if I'd been duped, had turned away. I felt remiss for how little I knew about wildlife on the tundra, how much animal intelligence I've lost. At least they knew better than to come any closer. There'd be four-wheelers and rifles in no time. I teetered for a moment on that tightrope. I wanted to walk back into the open and see whether the two animals would pause and look back. I wanted to feel the tang of their observation, to remember what it's like to be human. Arriving in the windy gloom of Savunga around 1 in the morning, still light out, I passed kids on their bikes. A man came from a plywood house to show me ivory harpoons dug out of the ruins of ancient, abandoned villages. Another man coming from another direction had pieces of mammoth ivory that were found in the tundra around here. At town hall, bingo was just letting out, people mounting their four-wheelers for home. In one of the only two-story buildings in the village, I turned up a flight of worn wooden stairs and opened a door onto the quiet room where my mom and I were staying. Microwave, styrofoam cups, coffee pot. My mom was asleep. I sat on my cot to unlace my boots, and she stirred. She cracked an eye and asked if I had a good walk. I said I did. I did not tell her how far I still had to go. The first people to enter Tasmania in the South Pacific 36,000 years ago, becoming the southernmost Ice Age hunters, ate wombats and wallabies and used bone points hafted onto wooden shafts. In Borneo, about the same time, Paleolithic hunters fashioned stingray spines into barbed spear points and used them to take down wild pigs, monkeys, turtles, and civet cats. Farther north, people hunted larger animals, and their tools became more robust, made of napped bone and rock to match the size of their prey. At an upper Paleolithic site in southern Portugal, firecracked rock and stone anvils have been found among the systematically smashed bones of deer, bison, reindeer, and horse, evidence of marrow rendering. The north was a harder place to survive, requiring adaptation to deep winters. In the Ach Valley of southern Germany, young, nursing-age mammoths were hunted in the spring and early summer. A cave there produced the remains of a cave bear killed by human hunters. The beast would have been 15 feet tall on its hind legs. The tip of a flint spear point was found stuck in its vertebrae just under the shoulder blade. The blow would have come from its right flank, probably aimed at the heart or lungs, but stopped short. It was not a killing blow. More spears and spear thrusters must have been on hand. The bear's skeleton was found scribed with butchering marks, the robe of its fur taken off, signs that humans had won the day. People were well established in parts of Siberia by 30,000 years ago. Crossing the land bridge, even if they had no idea what lay ahead, they would have known that the country was changing. The first appearance of short-faced bears, the last sight of woolly rhinos. Even the beetles on one side were different from the beetles on the other. People would have known they were entering a new world. When my mom and I flew back to the mainland, we landed in Nome, Alaska, where the land bridge once ramped onto the upper left-hand corner of North America. Here, people would have seen the first topography since the peaks of St. Lawrence Island, the land rising ahead of them into bright glaciers and rock outcrops. The treeless mountains standing above the town are visible 50 miles out to sea, out to land. A broken length of woolly mammoth tusk was found about 100 miles northeast of here, near the coastal town of Kotzebue, Alaska. The tusk, which dates to 36,000 years ago, had been scored by stone tools. One archaeologist described it as a cutting board. Its antiquity may be irrelevant. The tusk could have been found and cut much later. This is where dates become hard to track. What is a sign of people, and how old might it be? Not far west of this find, among the tors of Serpentine Valley on Alaska's Seward Peninsula, fluted spear points for hunting megafauna have been found, along with charcoal from willow fires with dependable radiocarbon dates around 12,000 years old. Beyond that, in a cave in the Yukon Territory, a butchered horse jaw has been dated to 24,000 years ago, the bone cut when it was still fresh. The land bridge remains a hypothesis. Though early people are found on both sides, no physical artifacts or sites have been discovered to prove that they crossed through here. Atlantis has sunk and taken the artifacts of a thinly spread Ice Age people down with it. Let's say, for argument's sake, that the first people walked across the land bridge from Siberia and set up camps and seasonal territories on its expanse for many generations. For anyone heading east toward the rising sun into more of the same grassland steppe and winding rivers, the mountains above Nome may have been the first glimpse of North America. Just above town stands Anvil Mountain. Four massive radio antennas have been placed there, defunct remains of a Cold War communication network, good views of the Bering Sea as well as inland. This is the White Alice site, a former sentinel for aircraft and ballistic missiles coming through polar airspace. These aren't spindly antennas with red lights flashing on their tips. They are large corrugated parabolas like drive-in movie screens. One pair now faces the sea, with Russia just over the horizon. The other aims into the rest of Alaska, Canada, and all of North America, a tropospheric bounce from here into the rest of the United States. Signals of incoming weaponry sent to Southeast Alaska would jump to an underwater cable that could get a message down the West Coast and across to Washington, D.C. in half an hour, following a potential migration route of the First People, a convenient corridor of travel along the coast. Another signal was sent through the Canadian interior, also an ancient migration route, as if the land keeps offering a way and we keep taking it. Shut down in 1979, replaced by satellite telemetry watching for nuclear launches, this site no longer communicates. Concrete bases are cracked and invaded by tundra. Bolts holding down the metal struts of each parabolic superstructure are dull gray from oxidization. The place was empty but for wind and a distant herd of muskox grazing among willows, their winter fur raked off by branches. The summer sky was clear around us, the air crystalline, light within light, as if we were inside a bright Arctic seashell. My mom waded into the gnarled, thigh-deep willows. She filled her pockets with soft muskox wool, called kivyut. The act was so old, so natural, I don't think she was aware of its significance. The wool felt good in her hands, warm on her cheeks. She couldn't help reaching out for it, as if the impulse ran in her bones, in her ancestry, from the time when we used to do this, not just Beringians, but all people. It wasn't that long ago that this was how we spent most of our time, fingers plucking wool from bushes, pecking one stone with another, watching the sky for countless lifetimes, the sun circling with no end. In the late Pleistocene, my mother would have carried a basket or woven sack, filling it with coarse, reddish mammoth wool, or maybe the pale wool of Pleistocene horses combed off by twigs as they browsed the willows. Everything up here was shaggy. Scimitar cats and American lions, the great short-faced bear Arctotis, all wore heavy capes for winter, and would have been mangy in the warm Ice Age summers, the ground clumped with their shed hair. My mom would have worn skins and leggings and carried a pouch of small stone blades of Asian design. Eyed sewing needles made from mammoth ivory have been found on both sides of the land bridge, in context from 24,000 to 14,500 years ago. She would have used the small blades to cut skins and the needles to sew tailored, tight-fitting clothes, the things that had to be invented as people moved north. If she were anything like the first robust signs of people in the Siberian Arctic, just across the land bridge 24,000 years ago, my mom might have been adorned with bone beads or the teeth of animals drilled and strung on a cord. These were people with preferences and sensibilities. Curtis Marion at the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at Arizona State University told me, "A child from 20,000 years ago would be a fully modern human, well within the range of variation of modern humans today. That means they would have looked like us and been able to act like us. An Ice Age kid might have navigated public school as well as any. If we saw one of them strolling around the White Alice site, a Paleolithic daydreamer dressed in a jacket and jeans, and he or she waved to us, we would have waved right back. These people came here with languages and customs, body adornments, styles of weaponry, tailored clothing, pole and hide structures, and burial rites involving red ochre. They were not a blank slate." Diane Hansen, the head of the anthropology department at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, warned me not to assume that this means we're the same as them, however. She and her colleagues make the same mistake. "Have you read our papers?" she asked, telling me that the first people are written about from a dry academic vantage. "We tend to make them look like us, like an academic department, a bunch of people in their 30s sitting at their desks waiting to publish." As my mom browsed through the willows, scooping up muskox wool, I climbed on top of wind-crazed outcrops of schist, looking down to the blue arc of the Bering Sea. It felt as if the great shell of the sky were opening. I wandered back through willows around the base of the towers, ducking along muskox trails in the warm, hairy scent of beasts. A muskox was still here, its head down grazing, teeth snapping at summer grass. It lifted its gaze, and two boxy brown pupils stared at me from so close I could have tapped the animal with a stick. I'd never been this close to such an unfamiliar animal, all head, haunch, and horn. I figured I'd hear one of them first, not that I'd walk smack into it. I'd encountered a muskox in Greenland, out with a couple scientists at the edge of the glaciers. We scared up a bull on a ridgetop. It huffed and stomped about 50 feet away, hooves chomping the snow, an encounter that gave me an entirely different impression than the one beneath the radio towers. This was at the end of a dirt road out of Nome. The wildness diminished. Grass hung from its mouth, and it blinked. The animal did not care that I was here. It let out a huff through long, flattened nostrils and lowered its head to eat. The muskox knew my kind, accustomed to the dirt road to White Alice and the occasional harmless, useless visitor. I was part of its daily machinations, hardly worth thinking about. The beast's eyes were slotted and darkly marbled, the mustache above its nostrils damp from its breath. Its head was like a great anvil, its body more haunch and horn than back or hind legs. I stepped backwards, and backwards again, retreating down the trail. The sharpness of my vision in that moment may explain why Paleolithic caves of Spain and southern France have been painted and scratched with animal shapes rendered with an artist's accuracy and flair. Those encounters were cleaner than what we have today. Everything about the animal would have been located instantly. Angle of horn, flatness of mane, legs at a run, or body standing still. The presence of giant animals was life and death, and they were everywhere. In the cave paintings, the horn of the woolly rhino was given echoing outlines that convey movement, drawing your eye, saying, "This is the part you have to watch out for." The way we now speak in texts or remember the turns on and off ramps during morning traffic, that is how they once grasped animals. There was seniority on the land, and it was not human. Chapter 2. Inner Beringia, 25,000 years ago. In my 20s, I left my job reporting for a weekly newspaper in a small Colorado mountain town. My career as a journalist lasted 2 years, long enough for me to save up and hit the road for Alaska with a college buddy. All I left behind was a post office box and the teepee in the woods where I'd been living. Todd Robertson and I had guided a few summers for a dubious wilderness canoe outfit around Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah. We knew something about rivers and had a canoe tied to the top of his truck. That was our fortune. We were free to disappear. It was 1992. In the town of Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, Todd and I launched our blue canoe and 50 days worth of gear into a Yukon River freshly purged of spring ice, as far out on the planet as either of us had ever been. I think about mammoth skeletons found in the bottom of a South Dakota pit, where more than 60 juvenile and adolescent male Colombian mammoths stumbled at different times, becoming mired in warm spring mud they could not escape. But no female mammoths were found in the bone assemblies. If mammoth's social structure resembled that of modern elephants, these young males did not belong to a herd with a dominant bull, moving with females and their offspring. They were young, energetic outcasts looking for a home. All those skulls and tusks jumbled around at the bottom of the pit. I imagine the adolescent males trotting along one at a time, tusks lifted proudly in the air before they tumbled over the edge and out of sight. Todd and I were like young mammoths, itching to go. Not that wandering great distances is solely a male occupation. About 500 miles downstream on our journey, we encountered an all-female raft, dreadlocks and tans, the butt of a rifle sticking up from their gear. The need to get the hell out there is a shared trait. But young males, based on the South Dakota mammoth site, seem to be more likely to end up with their bones jumbled at the bottom of a hole. Several hundred river miles below Whitehorse, the Yukon left the mountains and spilled across the Arctic Circle. We were bug-bitten and bearded, melded into our canoe as if we lived in it. Inner Beringia opened wide, nothing but sky, river, and scrawny island forests ahead. Almost a month of mosquitoes, bears, and wild water through canyons lay behind us, Where inundated forests had been collapsing into the river from spring runoff, their mast-sized trunks rolling in the current. We were in a sprawl of channels and sloughs. The Yukon River poured across the flat Alaskan interior like a jug of water dumped on a tabletop. 6 miles wide, the river was a labyrinth of braids and spindled black spruce on islands with long, curving shores. The Arctic sun made circles around our heads like a tilted hula hoop. It was hard to tell just by looking if it were 9 at night or 5 in the morning, sunsets and sunrises drawn out for hours, inseparable. In the flats, I insisted on taking the front of the canoe. From the bow, I didn't have to look at our gear strapped into the boat or the back of Todd's baseball cap, a thing I'd been staring at for weeks. I wanted to be first, the prowhead of a boat cutting into the unknown, the sky inhaling us. But we were nowhere near first. Before us came Athabascans and Inuit and the linguistic roots of Uto-Aztecan people. There were island hoppers and land bridgers from Asia, mammoth hunting camps cropped up on the Tanana, the next big river south of the Yukon, while up the Yukon's tributaries, human signs have been found dating back to at least 24,000 years ago, some say 40,000 years. At the time, I didn't know about these older dates or sites. The word Paleolithic was not on my tongue. I knew we weren't first, but it sure felt like it. Holding on to time on the river was difficult. I'd pull out my pocket watch and look at its hands as if they spelled out an arcane message. The lack of mechanical time made space seem transparent. There was no Alaska, no North America. Earth wasn't an orb in space. It was a turtle swimming through a primordial sea, its shell so old and enormous it had grown mountains and glaciers like barnacles. The arrow of early American migration hooked through the heart of Mammuthus primigenius habitat, country of the woolly mammoth. This animal's range was defined by steppe, which stretched from Paris to New York, Asia and Beringia in the middle. When humans began to appear on this side of the world, the Laurentide ice sheet was for the most part welded into its mountainous neighbor to the west, the Cordilleran ice sheet, which blocked the way. During warmer parts of the ice age, when ice sheets separated, a corridor opened between them and allowed the woolly mammoth to pass through the cool grasslands and exploded glacial kettles of Alberta into Montana and the Dakotas, opening onto the rest of the Americas. Homo sapiens and Mammuthus primigenius occupied the same ecosystem, sharing a jigsaw puzzle of summer grasses, skinny trees, distant ice caps. It was one long country, and it stretched from Western Europe to the American heartland, from France and Scandinavia to the Great Lakes region and the northeastern seaboard of North America, bound in the middle by the land bridge. Tusks and skeletons are regularly found in the permafrost of the far north, where Siberian fossil hunters use pickaxes and hoses to blast them out of the cut banks along rivers where the animals once grazed and died. These are the same places where some of the first humans appeared, following the mammoth, or at least following the biotically rich steppe where the great beasts trod. The body of a mammoth calf with strawberry blonde fur was found preserved in Siberian permafrost, while the adults appear to have been more coppery and brown. Mammoth fur consists of two distinct layers, one composed of long, coarse guard hairs, 6 times thicker than human hair and up to 3 feet long, and an inner layer of shorter, softer, thinner hairs for insulation. Too heavy and dirty for most uses, it's not a hide you'd necessarily cut into pieces and wear. There would have been plenty of other animals to use for hides. Caribou, horse, deer, bison. Muskox would have been hunted and caped, their fur lighter and better adapted to cold than mammoths. A major mammoth excavation in Siberia is the Bear Lek site, near the mouth of the Indigirka River on the Arctic Ocean coast. This was a dying ground, a Siberian graveyard of bones, including the remains of at least 120 individual mammoths. During lean times, starving elephants are known to gather in places where food or water is more easily found. Sometimes they die there. This appears to have been the case for the woolly mammoths at this Siberian site. Excavators used a water pump to melt permafrost and found reddish gold wool and mats of guard hairs. They exposed partially rotted flesh and a well-preserved mammoth hind leg still bearing skin. 99% of the remains they found came from mammoths, the rest from cave lions, woolly rhinoceroses, horses, reindeer, bison, and more than 8,000 willow grouse, estimated by the plethora of tiny bones. No human kills have been found at Berelek. The mammoths appear to have died on their own. The humans came here like any other carnivore, drawn by the smell of meat, scavengers like the bears, big cats, and wolves. They left blade-like rock flakes and thin stone knives, and some of the bones of the mammoths were cut where meat was taken off. Among rotting rib cages along the banks of the Berelek, people left behind a handful of small pendants, polished stone with drill holes for wearing or hanging. An artifact hunter found a piece of mammoth tusk upon which a ghostly long-legged mammoth had been etched, an early artist scratching on a chunk of mammoth bone. I see her or him in an autumn chill, grinding into the bone as willow grouse clucked and rattled their throats in evening light. Artifacts at Berelek appear to have been left around 12,000 years ago, a later occurrence than the very first people. The teardrop-shaped stone projectiles found at the site are more Alaskan in origin than Asian, suggesting the door of the land bridge swung both ways. It was all one land, one ecosystem, no reason to go east any more than west. Sergei Zimov, a Siberian ecologist working to preserve the remains of Mammoth Steppe in Russia by introducing natural grazers and removing humans, wrote in the journal Science, "In the mammoth ecosystem, the collective behavior of millions of competitive herbivores maintained the grasslands. In the winter, the animals ate the grasses that grew the previous summer. All the while, they fueled plant productivity by fertilizing the soil with their manure, and they trampled down moss and shrubs, preventing these plants from gaining a foothold." Zimov believes that if mammoths could be brought back through genetic miracles to repopulate the far north, they could help restore one of the world's largest relic ecosystems. At its prime, populated by mammoths, sloths, and bison, the Mammoth Steppe was a rapid processor of CO2, which helped cool the northern hemisphere. Among big herbivores, one new calf a year can increase the population 100 times in 20 to 25 years, enough to knock down trees and mow grasses to the ground. That causes increased reproduction among grasses, a feedback loop leading to a global pasture. This rich, biologically productive, planet-cooling biome took up most of the high northern hemisphere, working the atmosphere like a machine. All of this on a turtle's back. Native American DNA split from its Eurasian roots around 30,000 years ago. While in the New World, the oldest genomes to have been discovered come from 13,000 years ago. Between these dates, the first people seem to have been floating out there, little to no linguistic or genetic contact with the rest of the world. This has given rise to the Beringian standstill hypothesis, the idea that the first people simply stopped up here before they entered the Western Hemisphere, balanced at the top of the world, Siberia, Alaska, and Northwest Canada. Adapted to cold conditions at the northern heart of the Mammoth Steppe, they may have waited to go forward into the rest of the Americas for thousands of years, in which time people learned of mammoth graveyards and used different technologies, telling one age or region from the next. Pollen counts from the time reveal an abundance of wildflowers, grasses, and island ecosystems of birch and spruce, all of which were favored by Beringia's mammoths and giant sloths. For the most part, the path any farther into North America was blocked by ice. During warmer ages, corridors opened between ice caps, letting bison and mammoths pass, mixing the animal genes of two hemispheres, like taking big, deep breaths between sides of the planet. Of course humans were caught up in one of these breaths. When early humans appeared in Alaska and neighboring Yukon territory between about 24,000 and 15,000 years ago, ice was at its maximum. Humans may have been drawn east out of Siberia, but when they got here, the door to the New World was closed. The far side of Beringia, the Alaskan interior, would have formed a glacial wall, with tongues of ice lapping across wind-blasted tundra and bare rock. You'd be better off staying with the rivers and giant animals of inner Beringia than venturing into this white oblivion, nearly 2,000 miles of ice to the nearest landfall, and, during the last glacial maximum, no easily navigable coastline. The question shouldn't be, did the standstill happen, but rather, why didn't they stay here longer? You could get lost out here, so much country, so many rivers winding into each other, that groups could have gone years or entire generations without seeing others. There must have been lost clans and hermits, people up in caves forgetting the rest of the world. After 8,000 years of living this way, if the standstill hypothesis is correct, new linguistic and genetic entities would have formed, Beringia becoming a womb for a new people. I did not know it had been a womb. To me, it was a river, with a sky stretched over it. If it was giving birth to anything, it was more horizons. We slept when the sun tipped near the ground, our two tents set on gravel bars for the long sunset. This low sun gave us only a few hours until it baked us out again and sent us back to the river. For 20 hours at a time, we paddled, slept, pissed into cans, and watched horizons rise ahead and fall behind. The only other people in our world were animals. We became familiar with the sound of snorting moose as they swam wide channels for other islands, the crowns of caribou antlers rising through the tops of willow shrubs, a grizzly standing on a faraway flood-stripped island on all fours, watching us with mild interest. We were passing through territories with boundaries we couldn't see, herds and predators, the long exploratory howls of wolves rising from the taiga. The first known human architecture appears in Siberia by 23,000 years ago, when the only way to survive year-round without having to migrate south was a well-built shelter. Circular huts were constructed, 20-some feet across, fire hearths near the center, hides draped over wooden posts and beams, their bottoms held down by a ring of caribou antlers or mammoth bones. Todd and I carried tents framed with plastic bones and thin metal poles, bug screens, and nylon. To Pleistocene travelers accustomed to hides on wood frames and floors dug into the earth, peeled down to permafrost, our tents would have looked as if we were draping ourselves nightly in gossamer. What would have been the use? People have different needs at different times. Our tents kept out mosquitoes. Theirs warded off giant bears and Beringian wolves. A piece of ground to defend. The difference between travelers and inhabitants. Mammoth stories still exist in northwest Siberia, recorded by ethnographers interviewing Ugric and Samoyedic speakers in the early 19th century. The beasts are known as Maksar or Muksar, translated to Earth Bull or Earth Horn. Shamans are said to have ridden them into the underworld. And in some stories, they were forced into underground exile. Mammoths were terrible and destructive creatures. They ripped up forests and laid waste to mountains. When they come to the surface, they die, turning to bones. This is why no living mammoths are found. An anthropological transcript taken from the Ugric tongue in northwest Siberia reads, "Nowadays, we do not see mammoths anymore. The sky god has doomed them to death. Only their horns, marrow, bone, and ribs can be found in sandy riverbanks." Too ruinous for this world, they were driven underground. I imagine them now huddled in the dark beneath our feet, making hardly a sound as they listen patiently to the ground above, waiting. They would have heard the quickening thaw of permafrost and the hiss of rivers carving through banks, releasing their buried tusks and massive long bones. The size of animals has decreased significantly since then, proboscideans gone from the north. Our bears look like pets compared to long-legged Arctotis. The world has changed. As the Yukon came down from its spring and summer runoff, cobble islands and bars revealed themselves from under flood stage. Uprooted trees grounded and gathered into log jams at the upstream ends. One evening, as the sun ran low, we landed on a naked teardrop-shaped island surrounded by a quarter mile of swift, cold, muddy water. We figured we didn't have to worry about bears, so we could put away our dainty bear bells. For most of the trip, we'd land on high alert, never cooking near where we slept, switching out dinner clothes for sleeping clothes, hanging our food in trees if we could. Forced into the woods by spring runoff, we'd been sleeping in the nests and trails of large bears, but islands like this seem safe. As we started unpacking and putting up our shelters, a large black bear, Ursus americanus, ambled up a far shoreline. We watched it, then went back to setting camp, glad to be across the current from the bear. Maybe 300 pounds, it studied the ground at the river's edge as if it had lost something. Its movements seemed anxious, preoccupied. We'd had good relationships with bears so far. For that, we were grateful, especially since we carried no firearms. Todd hated guns, and though I grew up around my dad and weapons and knew how to aim and shoot, I thought it was somehow more noble, closer to nature, to face the animals on their own terms. The bear jumped off its cutbank into the water. The loud crash reached us on the island, and we looked up from camp. The bear began swimming a fairy angle, positioning its nose upstream into the current. The calculation didn't require much thought. Current and distance divided by the power of the swimming stroke. The bear was angling for us. In the lower 48, we'd scare away black bears by banging pots and yelling. This animal wouldn't give a crap about that kind of racket. From across the channel, it could smell that we were unarmed. If it ate us, there were no other humans nearby to seek retribution. Where we were camped, how we unloaded gear, the way we stood staring blankly as it swam toward us, we told the bear exactly what it needed to know. First priority in Paleolithic minds, don't get eaten. Opportunities for a messy demise would have been everywhere. This is